The Guardian.
The Guardian's open journalism connects us. It brings us together when we need it the most. It arms us with the facts. It searches for answers. And it helps us to imagine a better tomorrow. But today, our advertising revenue and newspaper sales are falling faster than ever before, which means we need your support more than ever. Your support will sustain us and make sure that our open journalism stays open during this crisis and beyond. Support The Guardian today. Visit gu.com/support podcasts.
Welcome to The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism covering culture, politics and new thinking. For the text version of this and all our long reads, go to theguardian.com/longread.
The past 6 weeks have been unlike anything I've known. A GP on how the pandemic has changed his work. Following his previous in-depth account of the early days of the outbreak, Edinburgh GP Gavin Francis reports on how he and his practice have dealt with the escalating crisis since lockdown by Gavin Francis. Read by Greg Miller-Burns and produced by Esther Opoku-Jenny. By the time the schools closed in late March, my GP consulting room in Edinburgh had been emptied of clutter, its surfaces rendered easy to wipe down with disinfectant. It felt as if the decks had been cleared. There are almost 4,000 patients in my practice on the south side of the city, close to the university. As the lockdown began, my colleagues and I were spending our time phoning 200 or 300 of the frailest, as well as the 30 or so who had been advised by the government to shield from the virus until July at least. On the phone, we made sure they understood the advice to stay in and that they had arranged food deliveries for the coming weeks. We checked they had a key information summary, an electronic précis of their principal medical issues, available for paramedics, A&E and hospital staff to access should they become unwell. In the first few weeks of the year, the pandemic had been a dreaded but distant anxiety. I had little sense of how severely it would hit us, and how much planning would be enough. The speed of its arrival was startling, and the past 6 or 7 weeks have been unlike anything I've known in general practice. Everything about the way we work has been transformed. The number of face-to-face encounters with patients has dropped by 90%. Home visiting is both more time-consuming because of the requirement for personal protective equipment, or PPE, and perfunctory, to cut contact time. Dread has given way to fatigue, but not to complacency. I'm worried that too few people are being tested, that the test itself is often inaccurate, and that our PPE provision is inadequate. The health gap between rich and poor, already wide from a decade of cuts to councils and benefits, is being stretched wider. Now that restrictive lockdown measures are starting to be eased, cases will surely climb. My GP colleagues and I have all seen some patients with COVID-19. But because of the effectiveness of lockdown, fewer than forecast in those dark days of March, two of our patients have died of it. About the same proportion, 1 in 2,000, as have so far died of the virus nationwide. The agility of the NHS in response to the crisis has been impressive. Our practice has 4 GPs and 2 nurses. All still travel to and from the clinic every day, and the 4 receptionists are still fielding and triaging calls. The appointments book is filled as usual, but now with names for the clinicians to phone back, rather than with appointment times for patients to come in. The NHS is notorious for its slow uptake of technology. I still use fax machines and pagers daily, but we can now text patients' phones with a link to open a video call to our aged desktop PCs. There are still clinical problems for which a physical examination is imperative. Those I do at the practice if the patient is fit enough to come in, or at their home if they're not. Either way, I wear a mask, apron, and visor, and two pairs of gloves. As aspiring GPs, we're taught to value the subtleties of human communication, to carefully attend to body language, to silences, to the way a patient holds or evades eye contact. In a mask and visor, I feel less like a GP than an old-school surgeon, oblivious and insensitive. Two COVID hubs were set up in Edinburgh just before lockdown came in, one for the telephone triage and one for face-to-face assessments. A third was opened a week or two later, but then closed because there weren't enough patients to justify it. The idea was to keep patients with coronavirus away from their usual GP surgeries, where risk of cross-infecting others was high. I spent the evening of 19th of March at the telephone triage hub, when cases were still climbing steeply, with a glued and sellotaped headset. One finger in my uncovered ear, speaking to patient after patient reporting the same pattern of symptoms, a dry, irritating cough, as the virus irritates the upper airways, lack of smell, as the nose becomes infected, headache, a tight chest, fever, and a bone-weary, sagging exhaustion. A few complained of nausea, vomiting or diarrhea, as the virus upset the digestive tract. And fear. Everyone was frightened by what they had heard about this virus. The sickest patients were directed to the other COVID hub for a face-to-face assessment, and I began working there the following week. There is an efficient system in place to keep staff and other patients safe. Each patient is met at the door by a nurse in mask, gloves and apron, and has their name and date of birth checked. The patients are given a mask and gloves to put on themselves. They are led down a corridor to the assessment room, a freshly mopped, stripped out clinical space, and offered a seat. The doctor waits outside the room, puts on mask, apron, gloves and visor, and goes in once the patient is alone. My training as a GP emphasised the importance of building empathy and rapport. But on a shift in the COVID hub, I stay as far from the patient as possible, until the moment of actually examining them, even taking their medical history from the far side of the room. I remember seeing a middle-aged man there who had flown in from Italy not long before lockdown, another who had caught the virus at his mother's funeral, a builder who'd had a sick workmate on the last site he worked before lockdown, a young mother who thought she'd caught it on the train from London. On shift one, Thursday evening, we all stopped at 8 p.m. to listen for the sound of clapping. But the clinic is surrounded by hospital buildings, and the night was silent. "It makes my toes curl anyway," said one of my colleagues. "I'll be glad when it stops." "I like it," I said. "It's the one time of the week I get to see all my neighbours. For me, those Thursday rituals are far more about people cheering one another than they are about thanking the NHS. Scotland was at an earlier stage in the spread of the disease as lockdown came in. Even so, nationwide distancing measures should have come in earlier. By early April, with the upswing in cases steepening, we could all see that. Making call after call, seeing patient after patient, I thought how we'd been like toddlers on the beach, watching the waves edging ever closer and up the sand, but still squealing with shock when the water rolled over our toes. On the 3rd of April, Boris Johnson, at home isolating with coronavirus, posted a video online. He was visibly overbreathing, interrupting his sentences to take brief gasps. 2 days later, he was admitted to hospital, and on the 6th of April, he was moved into intensive care. The BBC was publishing flowcharts of how the transition of power would work if the Prime Minister died. The trajectory of his illness was by now familiar. A week or so of flu-like symptoms, and then, between day 7 and day 9, just as most patients start to improve, the onset of worsening breathlessness. COVID-19 has been called a biphasic illness.
For these two phases,
the first, virological, as the body confronts the virus, and the second, immunological, as misdirected messages from the immune system thicken the lungs and the lightest, aerious part of the body becomes sodden with fluid. In my part of Lothian, there are usually two cars providing emergency GP home visits, at the weekends and in the evenings. A few days after Boris Johnson was admitted to hospital, I was out in car two, driving to a visit in the most urgent triage category, which means getting to the patient within 1 hour. The experience was a fairly typical snapshot of what it's like to make home visits as a GP right now. On the phone, the patient had said that after a week of flu-like symptoms, he was breathless even when lying on the sofa and had a fever. It was early evening as I drove to his house. Westering sunlight was turning the suburban streets golden, and blackbirds were singing in the privet hedges. I phoned the patient from the car for directions. His breath came in gasps, his sentences interrupted. "Are you alone?" I asked. "Yes." "Can you sit near the door?" "Yes." "Just to warn you, I'll be wearing an apron, mask, visor, gloves. I'll give you a mask and gloves to wear too." "Okay. If you sit near the door, it's easier for me. I won't have to come all through the house to find you." "Okay." I ignored the twitching curtains of the neighbours, the kids out on their bikes. Earlier in the shift, leaving another home visit, a patient had asked me, "Can you shout to the neighbours that I don't have COVID?" Now I stood at the back of the car, opened the boot, and began the great faff. Another new protocol to get accustomed to. Thermometer, oxygen sensor, stethoscope, all placed into a clear plastic bag. Apron on, mask on, gloves on. Then a second pair of gloves over the first. The apron flew about in the wind. Some of my colleagues have been sellotaping the thin flapping plastic to their legs. Visor on last. His frame was 3D printed in green plastic, with clips for attaching a head strap to the back, and a clear acetate shield to the front. On the inside of the forehead band was written CAR 2 in permanent marker. At the patient's front door, which was ajar, I breathed in the smell of stale cigarette smoke. The man was sitting on a stool just inside the door, elbows on his knees, bracing his chest with his arms to better move air in and out of his lungs. He was wearing grey pyjamas that had lost a couple of buttons. "How are you doing?" he grunted in acknowledgement. "Can you manage on with one of these?" I handed him the mask, but he couldn't tie the strings of it. Wishing my forearms weren't bare, I leaned over him, holding my breath, and knotted the ties at the back of his head and neck.
I counted his breaths, fast, at 28 per minute. I put a digital thermometer in his ear, and it flashed red with an impressive fever.
I put an oxygen sensor over his finger. By shining light through the skin, it can gauge the oxygen content of the blood. His was worryingly low. His pulse, even sitting down, was galloping along at more than 2 beats a second. "Could you stand up for me?" I asked. We shuffled awkwardly on the small landing in a doleful dance. He turned his back, and I lifted his pyjamas to place my stethoscope on his back. The sound of air through his lungs was accompanied by a quiet, hissing sound, like sizzling fat. The sound of pneumonia. In his case, pneumonia probably caused by COVID-19. "I'm going outside, then I'll phone you about what happens next," I told him. I picked up the clear bag with my stethoscope, oxygen sensor and thermometer, and stepped out, trying to hold central to my awareness and every action that there was a virus on the walls, the door handle, my gloves and all my equipment. Out on the doorstep, I gulped down the fresh air. Then it was back to the rigmarole. topmost layer of gloves off and into a waste bag. Still wearing my under layer of gloves, I took a chloride wipe and began to clean all the equipment, stethoscope, oxygen sensor, thermometer, and placed them into yet another clear plastic bag, ready for the next patient. The wipe went into the waste, then my apron. Next, it was the visor's turn to get cleaned, and afterwards I placed it onto the ground to dry. Next, it was the visor's turn to get cleaned, and afterwards I placed it on the ground to dry. Then, undergloves off, mask off, the clinical waste bag tied off and sealed and back into the car. With the donning and doffing of PPE and cleaning all the equipment, home visits now take far longer than they used to. I'd be happier wearing a gown in addition to the gloves, mask and visor. It would better protect my arms, trunk and legs from droplets carrying the virus. But for now, there are no gowns available. A few days earlier, I'd looked through the supplies of gloves and masks that had been delivered to my practice from central government stores. The masks were stamped with the name of a Canadian company, manufactured in China, and distributed by another in Germany. My gloves were all manufactured in Malaysia or Vietnam. If we're to get this equipment to the people who need it in the UK, we need manufacturers here. And production should have started in January. From the car, I dialed the man's number again. All those years learning about personal, consultational styles. And now, I was breaking bad news by telephone from a car parked outside. As I waited for him to pick up, I glanced at the car mirror. My forehead was stamped with car 2 in reverse, transferred in sweat from the visor headband. "I think it's likely that you have coronavirus," I heard myself say. "And that it's affecting your lungs, causing pneumonia. That's why you feel so breathless." Silence. "I'll arrange for an ambulance to come and take you to hospital." I waited. His breathing was audible. "Is there anything you'd like to ask?" "How long for?" he said. "I don't know." Heading on to see the next patient, I passed the ambulance I'd just called, on its way to collect him. The paramedics both waved and I waved back. One, who wasn't yet wearing his mask, smiled. One of the few consolations of this pandemic is its grim camaraderie, a new fellowship among the fear. Later on, I walked along from the GP clinic to the A&E department to see how my patient had fared. One of the nurses called up his x-ray on the screen. The lungs should be light and spongy, the blackness of air clear against the white of the ribs, diaphragm and heart. But an infiltrate had clouded his lungs. Where there should have been a black void, there were speckled galaxies of white. "How old is he?" the nurse asked me. "Mid-50s, I said, like the Prime Minister. "Overweight?" she asked. I nodded. "They're all like that up in ITU," she said. "Strange days." We paused together for a moment in silence in front of the x-ray before she had to attend to another patient, as did I. Throughout April, I watched maps online showing the number of cases growing worldwide, with red dots bloomed into wide circles, like spores in a petri dish. Between the 1st of April and the 15th of April, they doubled from 1 million to 2 million. Deaths tripled from 50,000 to 150,000. Epidemiological studies were published showing that without limitation on its spread, the coronavirus has the potential to cause 30 million deaths, comparable to the Spanish flu of a century ago. Meanwhile, the lack of testing in the UK, even among healthcare staff, was becoming alarming. One of my colleagues came down with COVID-19 symptoms on a Friday, couldn't get tested until Monday, and by Wednesday evening we were still waiting for her result. 5 days from symptoms to result, 5 days of not having a GP working, 5 days as well of the GP's husband, a hospital doctor, not working as he too had to self-isolate. If doctors or nurses receive a negative result and feel well enough, they can go straight back to work. But there are doubts about the effectiveness of the test. Even high-quality studies estimate that it's accurate only about 70% of the time. We're just hoping that if there's insufficient virus in our throats and noses to detect, then there's insufficient to pass it on to others. As hospital cases plateaued in April, the virus began to take hold in nursing homes. There are two nursing homes on my practice's patch in Edinburgh. One had an outbreak affecting 4 or 5 patients, but it was swiftly and professionally contained. None of the residents died of it. The staff reassured me that they had sufficient PPE. I began hearing stories of nursing homes that weren't so lucky, that had seen every resident infected, and a quarter had died. I also heard of homes that had no protective masks or gloves. At the same time, it was obvious that, in the wider community, lockdown was helping slow transmission. The numbers in ITUs, intensive therapy units, dropped consistently from a peak around 9th of April. We GPs were sent a message of praise from the hospital, thanking us for doing so well at keeping people away. But it was becoming harder to field patient frustration at the shutting down of much of what the NHS used to do. No outpatient clinics, no colonoscopies, no sexual health services, no routine x-rays. So much has been put on pause. Even cancer services have been stripped back to the essentials, and many routine lab tests have been cancelled to create capacity for coronavirus testing. It's clear that though the lockdown has slashed transmission, it is provoking a silent epidemic of despair. Panic attacks, sleeplessness, and plunging moods are all difficulties GPs are encountering daily. Tough conversations to have at the best of times, but even tougher on the phone. Within our area of the city, we already know of suicides triggered by bankruptcies and business closures, and of marriages breaking down. Alcohol-induced injuries are up, as are injuries from assaults. Between the 23rd of March and the 12th of April, there were 16 deaths from domestic violence in the UK, more than triple the still shocking figure from last year. A police officer friend told me that domestic abuse support lines were experiencing a 30 to 40% increase in traffic. Samaritans and Childline 2 were receiving high volumes of calls. A domestic abuse hotline for NHS workers had been inaugurated, intended to support both health workers at risk and to offer advice should they suspect patients of being abused. When I check routine blood tests on my patients, I have been seeing new flares of liver irritation, which suggest rising levels of alcoholism. Many whose mental health was already tenuous before the crisis now feel unmoored, desperate and angry. The inescapable uncertainty that comes with the disease is particularly difficult to live with, and I'm grateful, as a GP, to at least have reliable work. For those whose jobs offered identity and a sense of purpose, being furloughed has been a tragedy exacerbated by forced disconnection from friends and family. Many children, my own included, are missing the structure and social life of school, and every day I hear of more best-laid plans being added to the bonfire of this global crisis. The UK maintains relatively few critical care beds in comparison with its neighbours. Before this crisis, there were around 40 ITU beds in Lothian for a population of 850,000. Now that number has been increased to 113. With the new critical beds added, the UK is at roughly the same levels as pre-pandemic Italy and Bulgaria. The peak of COVID-19 bed occupancy in Lothian's ITUs was on the 9th of April, when they were 42. 10 days later, they were 30, and they now stand at 11. A friend who is an ITU consultant in the Midlands told me that only 4 in 10 of his patients who are intubated due to COVID-19 survive it. On Sunday the 10th of May, Boris Johnson relaxed some lockdown measures for England, while Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland kept their own stricter measures in place. Johnson encouraged a return to work, but asked people to avoid public transport, and said that driving to work and to places for exercise would be permitted. I asked my ITU friend what he thought of the speech. No mention of face masks in public? Everybody in their cars? I think it's an experiment at the expense of the English, he said. On the 7th of May, the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, had extended our lockdown shortly after recommending the use of cloth face coverings on public transport, in shops, and in places where physical distancing isn't possible. On the 10th of May, she announced that she had asked the UK government not to deploy their Stay Alert advertising campaign in Scotland. The message in Scotland, Sturgeon said, was not stay at home if you can, but stay at home full stop. The lockdown has already had profound social and economic consequences. It's likely that unemployment is going to soar this summer, and unless robust housing legislation is put in place, so will evictions. On my occasional work at the Assess practice, a GP clinic providing health services for Edinburgh's homeless population, I've seen how they're preparing for a surge in need. In late March, the Scottish Government, public health officials, charities and local authorities came together to mitigate the worst of the pandemic's effects on homeless people with an initiative brokered by the charities Streetwork and the Bethany Trust. By the evening of the 24th of March, 80 of the city's rough sleepers had moved into rooms in one of the city's empty hotels, with homeless shelters closing to minimise the spread of COVID-19. Another hotel was opened as a temporary night shelter. Mobile outreach clinics were set up in each hotel, and rapid detox and methadone programmes initiated for those who needed them. I was due at the outreach clinic in one of the hotels last week, but just before attending, I came down with a viral headache. I felt weak, nauseated and feverish. So instead of going to the clinic, I went to a test centre, where a knitting needle of a swab was plunged into the depths of my nose. While waiting for the result, I phoned Rankin Barr, the service manager of Streetwork, to arrange a visit to the outreach clinic and asked them about the effects of lockdown. The people presenting for emergency shelter are not your traditional rough sleepers, he said. Many are coming from domestic problems, relationship breakdowns. With lockdown, they can't stay with family, can't go to B&Bs. We spoke of how much had been done so far, of the rapid setting up of clinics, of food provision, immigration advice and vaccination programmes, and how the City Council was even now procuring more emergency accommodation for the emerging social crisis. The calamity of the pandemic has triggered a new attitude, an approach to the city's chronic housing shortage. This virus has changed everything. But there's an opportunity from now to do things differently, Barr told me. The city and public health authorities are completely on board. We just can't lose all the vital work that's been done. My result came through negative. I felt better. And we'll be able to visit the outreach clinic later this week. On the phone recently, I asked one of the doctors organising treatment for the homeless, John Budd, how many cases he'd had to deal with. We've been lucky so far. Unbelievably, there has only been one confirmed case. That's perhaps symbolic of just how marginalised the homeless are from society. But when it enters this relatively closed community, it will spread like wildfire, he said. But this virus is like Voldemort, he laughed. We know it's out there. We just don't know when it's coming back.
For more Guardian long reads in text and a selection in audio, go to theguardian.com/longread or find us on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/theguardianlongread.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.